move to questions without notice. Are there any questions? And I give the call to the honourable member for Deakin.
Well, thanks very much, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Immigration. Over 500,000 visas have been granted under the Albanese Labor government in the past year, with more than 1.6 million projected to be granted over the next 5 years. Does the minister agree that this is putting immense pressure on housing, transport and basic services on top of a cost of living crisis already being faced by Australian families?
I give a call to the Leader of the House.
Mr. Speaker, the introduction refers to the minister's portfolio, and then the question is about a series of other portfolios. It is not a question to the Minister for Immigration. It doesn't in any way ask about his actions.
Order. Members on my left, the member for Barker will cease objecting so I can hear from the manager of opposition business. Yes. Manager has the call.
Mr. Speaker, the question goes squarely to the actions and the responsibilities of the Minister for Immigration in granting visas. This is entirely within his portfolio and it's an entirely appropriate question to be asked.
On the point of order. On the point of order.
Mr. Speaker, the question goes to consequences in other portfolios, not to the role of the Minister, not in any way whatsoever.
Yeah, look, if the manager can just resume his seat for a moment. Order. The member for Hume, we're just going to deal with this. I'm sure there's a way we can get past this, but the question is so broad, it is asking for an opinion. So under the standing, I'm going to the Leader of the Opposition just for a moment. The question was regarding visas granted. Because of the nature of the question being so broad, and the impact. So the minister can answer the question. It'll be a very broad answer. So it'll be very unlikely anyone could take a point of order on relevance because of the way that the question order, because just the way the question has been framed. So I'm going to allow the question. The member is entitled to ask the question, but just moving forward, I want to make sure that members simply can't be asked an opinion under the standing orders. That is going to be ruled out. So if the minister can refer to his answer regarding the visas being granted, on the point of order.
Mr. Speaker, the member for Herbert made an interjection that was a reflection on the speaker and should be withdrawn.
Well, I'd be disappointed if that's the case, but the member for Herbert will withdraw.
I'll withdraw.
Order. The Minister for Social Services. So with that guidance to the Minister, he has the call.
Thank you, Speaker. The Albanese government is getting on with fixing Australia's broken immigration system, a system broken by those opposite.
Order.
And no more so than when the Leader of the Opposition was the Minister
Order.
Responsible.
Members on my left.
I'm proud to be working with my friend, the Minister for Home Affairs, to build a system that Australians can
Order.
Trust, helping us get the skills we need while bringing migration levels down to normal levels. We understand that
Member
competent
Deakin
and sensible administration of our visa system is something that is fundamentally important, ensuring that we do remain an attractive destination whilst bringing migration levels down. And we are doing that because of five decisions, five actions the government has taken. Closing COVID loopholes opened up by those opposite.
Yeah.
Strengthening integrity,
Order.
Unlike the former minister who halved immigration compliance. Ending settings that drive long-term temporary stays. Tackling exploitation, another matter on which he sat on his hands. And targeting skilled migration so that we are addressing genuine shortages. Now, Speaker, Martin Parkinson, the former Treasury Secretary, described the, and I quote, absolutely and utterly broken migration system as a reflection of, and I quote again, almost a decade of willful neglect, symbolised, of course, as members opposite should recognise, by the 1 million visas
Order.
In the in-tray when we came into government.
Member for Hume.
Businesses couldn't get the workers they need. migrants and other workers were being exploited.
The minister will pause. Order. The Minister for the Environment will cease interjecting. The Leader of the Opposition on a point of order.
Mr. Speaker, on relevance, and you gave good direction before. You gave good direction to the minister to say that he could broadly range on the issues in relation to those that he'd been asked, but only this minister could stray beyond
Resume your seat. Well, get to the point of order and not add additional commentary to the questions. The point of order is on relevance.
It's on relevance, Mr. Speaker. The government has allowed 500,000 people in during a cost of living crisis.
Resume your seat. The member for McEwen, and this is exactly the point I tried to raise before, with a broad question asking about opinions, the minister is going to be completely relevant because he was asked just about such a broad range of topics, and he is talking about his decisions as a minister and the actions he's taking. He couldn't be more relevant. The minister has the call.
Thanks, Speaker. And it seems that the Leader of the Opposition doesn't like being reminded of his record as a minister. Perhaps he should also remember what he said as Leader of the Opposition very recently. He said this: we do need an increase in the migration numbers. He will say and do absolutely anything, this bloke, absolutely anything. It isn't just about dividing Australians.
Order.
We are focused on rebuilding the migration system that he broke.
Yeah. Order. Order. When the House comes to order, the Minister for Home Affairs and the Member for Lindsay will cease interjecting. Give a call to the Member for Hasluck.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Deputy Prime Minister. How will the Albanese Labor Government's response to the Surface Fleet Review shape the Royal Australian Navy for decades to come, and what alternatives are there?
Give a call to the Minister, the Deputy Prime Minister and the Minister of Defence.
Well, can I thank the member for her question and acknowledge her service. Last Tuesday, the government announced its plan for the future Royal Australian Navy surface fleet, which will see an increase in the number of our surface combatants from 11 to 26, giving us the most capable Navy in the country's history. And it will also see an acceleration of the acquisition of those surface combatants, such that the first will come into service this decade in 5 years, not 10. But the most important point is that this is a plan which is paid for, with an $11.1 billion increase in defence spending to fully fund the $54 billion it will take to make this happen. So this is real. This is not make-believe. This is not the kind of announcement that we were used to from those opposite, such as the $35 billion guided weapons program, where they only put $1 billion on the table. And this increase, combined with the increases in last year's budget, will see defence spending go to 2.4% of GDP by the early 2030s. And that compares to what we inherited from those opposite, which was taking defence spending to 2.1%. Now, we have heard a lot from the Liberals over the last couple of months about defence spending. They and their little coven of supporters have been dancing around the fire, whipping each other into a frenzy, and as they have been barking at the moon, we have...
Order. Order. Members on my right will cease interjecting. Order. Order. The member for Moreton is warned. I'm trying to hear from the manager of opposition, who's entitled to raise a point of order.
Mr. Speaker, on relevance, I invite you to consider what was, in fact, a quite tightly drafted question, to consider whether the Deputy Prime Minister is entitled to be venturing into the territory that he's going into now.
The question contained what are the alternatives. So the Minister, order, the Deputy Prime Minister needs to ensure his answer contains the alternatives that he was asked about, not simply his opinions about former decisions.
We even heard the Shadow Minister suggest that if there wasn't increased spending, there should be resignations. Now, I always think one should be a little careful going to this space, lest one establishes a standard for yourself that you yourself cannot meet. Because when you strip away all the moon barking, what we are left with is the Shadow Treasurer saying that defence spending should be within the envelope which they took to the last election. That's 2.1% by the early 2030s. When the Shadow Minister for Defence has been asked whether he supports an increase in defence spending, he's consistently said he can't commit. And all the while, the Leader of the Opposition on this issue has been completely silent. And so what that means is that the policy of those opposite is 2.1, 2.1, 2.1, and what that means is that represents a cut in defence spending. The Albanese Labor government is committed to increasing defence spending to 2.4% of GDP to give us the surface fleet we need to keep Australians safe.
The House comes to order. I'll hear from the Deputy Leader of the Opposition.
My question is to the Minister for Housing. Over 500,000 visas have been granted by the Albanese Labor government in the past year, with more than 1.6 million projected to be granted over 5 years. Does the minister agree that Labor's policy of granting 500,000 visas in just 1 year has contributed to the average weekly cost to rent a unit in Frankston rising from $350 when Labor came to government to $420 today?
There is far too much noise. Order, members on my right. Order, the Minister for Home Affairs. It's not going to operate like that. Everyone knows the questions have to be heard in silence so the Minister can be heard in silence. It's a two-way street. Out of courtesy, the Deputy Leader will ask her question again and there will be silence so I can hear the question and hopefully everyone else can too. The Deputy Leader has the call.
My question is to the Minister for Housing. Over 500,000 visas have been granted by the Albanese Labor government in the past year, with more than 1.6 million projected to be granted over 5 years. Does the minister agree that Labor's policy of granting 500,000 visas in just 1 year has contributed to the average weekly cost to rent a unit in Frankston rising from $350 when Labor came to government to $420 today?
Whoever is making noises like that is completely disrespectful. It will not happen. The Minister for Housing, Homelessness and Small Business has the call.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker. And I thank the member opposite for her question. As she would know, if we'd kept the migration settings as they were when they left office, we would have more migrants today than there are in this country because, of course, they left a mess and we're busy cleaning it up, whether it is in migration or whether it is in housing. What we're doing in housing, of course, is we are adding to supply, Mr. Speaker. We have committed over $25 billion in new housing investments over the next decade, Mr. Speaker. We understand that the answer to the housing issues in Australia today is supply. Mr. Speaker, they're very noisy over there. Of course, they were very noisy opposing the Housing Australia Future Fund that would actually build homes for Australians that need it, Mr. Speaker. And of course, we know that they're going to oppose our Help to Buy scheme, Mr. Speaker, which would actually get more Australians into home ownership, Mr. Speaker. They claim they support home ownership, but they're voting against more homes for Australians. They're voting against getting more Australians into home ownership, Mr. Speaker. And indeed, we've heard a lot of criticism from them about us actually having a plan and an aspiration to build 1.2 million homes over the next 5 years, Mr. Speaker. We are working with the states and territories. We have $3.5 billion on the table to incentivise the states and territories to do the reforms that are necessary to get the homes on the ground for Australians that need them, Mr. Speaker.
Order. The minister will pause. The minister was asked about the costs of units. and housing, so she's answering why, and she's being directly relevant, so I'll hear from the Deputy Leader of the Opposition.
With respect, Mr Speaker, my question is on relevance, and I don't believe the Minister is being directly relevant. My question was about the price of rents in Frankston, what it was then and what it is now. It was about the different cost to rent in Frankston then and now. I think it's quite specific, Mr Speaker.
On the point of order, I want to hear from the Leader of the House, and I want to then talk about opinions which ministers are being asked for. The Leader of the House.
Yeah, Mr Speaker, just raising as a point of order that when you have just explained before someone takes a point of order that someone's clearly relevant, it seems that the point of order then becomes a simple contesting of the ruling rather than an actual point of order if you've just ruled on it.
Order. The Leader of the House makes a relevant point. The Deputy Leader is entitled to take a point of order on relevance, but a lot of leeway has been given so far, and that leeway doesn't necessarily have to continue on that way. But just so that everyone knows moving forward, we've had two questions now from the opposition regarding opinions of ministers. That, once again, as we saw for the first question, enables a very broad answer. If you're asking someone's opinion, not a policy question, not a necessary a responsibility, the minister is going to be very broad, so it's very difficult to make a point of order on relevance. Hope that's clear for everyone. The minister in continuation for 1:30.
Thanks, Mr Speaker. I don't know if 1 minute's going to be enough time for me to talk about all the things we're doing in housing, actually, Mr Speaker. The $2 billion social housing accelerator, Mr Speaker, that, of course, the money is with the states, and we are announcing homes right across Australia from that money already. 4,000 new social homes over the next few years in partnership with the states and territories, Mr Speaker. Just last week, Mr Speaker, I was in Perth with the Prime Minister and the Premier and the Housing Minister in Western Australia, where we announced another 219 apartments for Australians that need them, Mr Speaker. This is the sort of thing that we can fund through the Housing Infrastructure Facility. And of course, we have already unlocked $575 million, and we're putting another $1 billion into this facility, Mr Speaker. We have already supported 4,937 new homes since we came to office through Housing Australia, and we look forward to doing more. As I said, the announcement in Perth was just one of many that we have made and will continue to make, Mr Speaker, because, of course, we are getting homes off the ground, whether they be in Western Australia, whether they be in Victoria, Mr Speaker, where, of course, 2,500 homes were announced last time I was in Victoria, Mr Speaker. We know we need to add to supply right across the country, and we're getting on with the job of providing more homes for all Australians that need them, Mr Speaker.
Give the call to the honourable member for Holt.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. How will the government's new tax cuts benefit Australian families, and how will they help to build a better future?
Give the call to the Prime Minister.
Thanks very much, Mr Speaker. And I'm pleased to get a question about cost of living. And you know it'll be from this side of the House. You know it'll be from this side of the House. And I thank the member for Holt. We are giving a tax cut to some 13.6 million Australian taxpayers. Every Australian taxpayer, not just some. The Leader of the Opposition, first they said they'd oppose it. Then they said they'd roll it back. Then they wanted an election on it. Then they rolled over and voted for it. But now it's before the Senate, and they're talking it out there, trying to delay a vote in the Senate. But the fact is that this is good policy, which is why they knew they had no choice eventually but to still continue to argue against it, still complain about it, whilst they didn't vote against it. Because we know that at the first opportunity, this is the sort of policy that they would roll back, because in a moment of honesty, they said that was their position.
Absolutely.
Now, we want Australians to earn more, and last week we learnt that real wages in 2023 increased much earlier than what the Treasury estimates were. So our objective of people earning more and keeping more of what they earn is being met. Those opposite, of course, we know want people to work longer and they want people to work for less. These tax cuts will make a significant difference.
Leader of the opposition.
A shop assistant on $32,000 will get a $414 tax cut. Yeah. A nurse on $76,000 will get a tax cut of $1,579. Yeah. A teacher on $80,000, $1,679. A police officer on $110,000 will benefit to the tune of $2,429. Our tax cuts are aimed directly at middle Australia because we know that that is the right thing to do. Those opposite, of course, can change what they say, but they'll never change what they stand for. They can change how they vote, but they'll never change who they are. Sneering and looking down on people, thinking that people under $45,000 a year are not worthy of a tax cut.
Members on my left
are not worthy of a tax cut. Not worrying about average workers. Average workers. Just worrying about themselves.
Before I call the honourable order, before I call the member for Kooyong, I'd like to acknowledge a few guests in the gallery. I'm pleased to inform the House that present in the gallery today is the Minister for Foreign Affairs from the Czech Republic, Mr. Jan Lebaski, and the Ambassador of the Czech Republic, Ms. Jana Trier. I'm also pleased to inform the House that present in the gallery today is the President of the Olympic Committee, Mr. Ian Chesterman, and the Chef de Mission for the Australian Olympic Team 2024, and former Australian gold medalist cyclist, Ms. Anna Mears, OAM. A warm welcome to you all. And now I give the call to the Honourable Member for Kooyong.
Thank you, Deputy Speaker. My question is for the Health Minister. Minister, the Health Committee's report into long COVID concluded that we need national indoor air quality standards to improve the safety of indoor spaces and reduce transmission of COVID-19 and other infectious diseases. The government's response last week acknowledged, but it did not adopt that recommendation. So, Minister, I ask you, how do you propose that we can keep our kids safe at school during the next outbreak of a severe airborne virus?
The call to the Minister for Health and Aged Care.
Well, thank you, Speaker, and I thank the member for Kooyong for her question, her deep interest before entering this place in public health, obviously, and her advocacy in the different debates that have happened in this building about how we respond to that once-in-a-century pandemic to ensure that we are better prepared next time. As the member has indicated, Mr. Speaker, we have delivered our response to the report that the Health Committee, led by the member for MacArthur, made, the inquiry into long COVID. A number of recommendations were accepted. Others were noted by the government. I don't have the full response in front of me. There are obviously a number of different measures there, and I'll come to the question of clean air very quickly. There are a number of different measures there that are important considerations for Australians who are dealing with long COVID, as it's broadly termed, particularly the longer version of long COVID, if you like, that involves quite complex symptomology for a considerable period of time. We take the view that there are significant opportunities within our existing Medicare system for people to receive care from their general practitioner and from allied health professionals, as there are for other chronic diseases. And we want to see those rolled out, along with better education for GPs and allied health professionals about that. The member's specific question, though, is in relation to clean air. And it is clear, as we entered the sort of back end of the emergency phase of the pandemic, that it did become clearer that this was an aerosol-based coronavirus, and that clean air was an important protection against infection. This is an area that involves significant regulation by states, particularly, for example, the regulation of school air and public hospital systems, and there are different actions that are being taken by state governments, as the member would be aware. But there is a lively debate or lively discussion that is continuing. I know in a couple of weeks there will be a workshop here in the Parliament led by the Australian Academy of Science, by the CSIRO, by the Burnett Institute, to continue that discussion about how we can provide better clean air. I will say this, though, Mr Speaker, to the member for Kooyong and others, that this is why the Labor Party took to the last election a commitment to deliver a Centre for Disease Control, to have one place where these debates can be coordinated, particularly in a federal system where there's very much split responsibility between the Commonwealth and state governments. And I know the member for Kooyong will want to continue to be a part of that discussion.
Call to the honourable member for Cunningham.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Education. What does the Universities Accord say about the future of higher education in Australia? And why is it important the government builds a better and fairer education system?
Call to the Minister for Education.
Thanks very much, Mr Speaker, and can I thank my friend, the sensational member for Cunningham, for her question. Can I also recognise in the public gallery the school teachers from Ukraine that are with us today? Welcome. Welcome to Australia. Mr Speaker, under Bob Hawke and Paul Keating, the number of kids finishing high school jumped from 40% to almost 80%. That includes a lot of us here. That was nation-changing stuff. On the weekend, I released the Universities Accord, and that's a blueprint for how we reform higher education in this country for the next decade and the decade after that. And what this report says is that by the middle of this century, we'll need a workforce where 80% of that workforce haven't just finished high school, but they've got a TAFE qualification or a university degree as well. And that's not going to be easy. To do this, what it says is we've got to break down two big barriers. We've got to break down that artificial barrier between TAFE and university, make it easier to move between the two, make sure that the two systems are more integrated and seamless. And it also says that we've got to break down that invisible barrier that stops a lot of young people from the outer suburbs and from the regions from getting a crack at university in the first place and succeeding when they get there. Today, almost one in two young people, young adults in their 20s and 30s, has a uni degree. But not everywhere, not where I'm from. In places like Fairfield, it's only 28%. In Maranoa, it's only 22%. In Elizabeth, in South Australia, it's only 12%. And that, at its core, is what the Universities Accord is all about doing something to change that. This report is jam-packed full of reforms to tackle this and other challenges, including things like fee-free university places, fee-free university courses, needs-based funding, making HECS simpler and fairer. And can I thank Professor Mary O'Kane, AC, and the Accord team for their report? The first stage of our response will come in the next few months. But, Mr Speaker, if we're going to succeed here, we can't just rely on reforms at the university gate, because the same kids who aren't getting a crack at university at the moment are the same kids who aren't finishing high school at the moment, who are falling behind in primary school at the moment, who aren't getting an opportunity to go to early education at the moment. So it is all connected. That's why we need to build a better and a fairer education system across the board that helps ensure that no one's held back and no one is left behind, because that's what we are going to need if we're going to build the skills and have the economic firepower to succeed in the decades ahead.
Give a call to the honourable member for Mallee.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Immigration. Many Australians can't find a home to live in. Our roads are gridlocked, and essential services like schools and hospitals are under growing strain. Why is the Albanese Labor government making it worse by granting over 500,000 visas in just one past year, with more than 1.6 million projected to be granted over 5 years?
Order. The Treasurer will cease interjecting. The Minister for Immigration, Citizenship and Multicultural Affairs has the call.
Thank you very much, Speaker. I thank the honourable member for her question, and I say to her and to all members that we are getting on with the job of fixing a system that was fundamentally broken by those opposite. And we see that.
Order.
And we see that in the in all of the issues that the member raised. But what is concerning to me is that the member opposite and many members opposite, on the one hand, talk about the need for skilled migration in their reasons, and on the other hand, come into this place and tell a different story. And what we should be entitled to expect is a bit of consistency, and that might start not just with the Leader of the Opposition, who should of course reflect on his deplorable record, but also the Shadow Minister, who said when he was in government, well, we need to get our international students back, we need to get our working holiday visa maker holders back, and get these people back as soon as we can. They should reflect on their record, and they should get behind our word in fixing the system that they broke.
Yeah. Order. Give a call. Order. The member for Barker is on a warning. So is the member for Deakin. So that means no more interjections from them, hopefully. Give the call to the member for Macon.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Defence Industry. How is the Albanese Labor government ensuring the Royal Australian Navy can play its part in Australia's defence? What impact will these decisions have on defence industry, and how is the government changing previous approaches?
Give a call to the Minister for Defence. Order. Give a call to the Minister for Defence Industry, the Minister for International Development and the Pacific.
Thank you, Speaker, and I thank the member for Macon for his question and his fierce advocacy for the defence of this nation. Last week's announcement by the Deputy Prime Minister and myself was the most consequential announcement for the surface fleet of the Navy since World War II. Our plan more than doubles the number of major surface combatants from 11 to 26.
Order.
And it's not just more vessels, it's getting them faster. Under the plan of those opposite when they're in power, we would have had one additional surface combatant vessel by 2034. Just one. Under our plan, we'll have four. 4-1, a quadrupling of the number. Importantly, they'll also be more lethal. The Leader of the Opposition's plan would have delivered 432 missile sales across the surface fleet. By contrast, our plan would deliver between 704 and 880 missile sales. Importantly, we'll sign the acquisition contract for the Hunter class this year, and we'll be cutting steel on the general purpose frigate in 2026. By contrast, those opposite didn't sign a single new acquisition contract for a major surface combatant in their entire sordid 9.5 years in government. Not a single one. Importantly, Speaker, we'll also be delivering continuous naval shipbuilding for South Australia. Once the Hunter class is finished, we'll immediately follow on with a replacement for the air warfare destroyer. And for the first time in the history of this nation, we're securing continuous naval shipbuilding in Western Australia, bringing forward the landing craft medium by 2 years, bringing forward by 7 years the landing craft heavy, immediately following on with 8 general purpose frigates and then the large optionally crewed surface vessels. All in all, our plan will support 3,700 direct jobs and thousands more in the supply chain. Thousands of well-paid, high-skilled jobs contributing to the defence of the nation. And my message to the electrician in Perth or the welder in Adelaide is you've got decades of work under the Labor government. You can pay a mortgage, you can raise a family and can contribute to the defence of the nation, secure in the knowledge that the Albanese government's got your back. And all of this is underpinned by real funding increases. Last week's plan was matched by an $11.1 billion funding increase to the defence budget, which built on the $30 billion of extra funding we provided in last year's budget. This brings the defence budget to 2.4% of GDP over the decade. By contrast, those opposite are still committed to a 2.1% spend on the defence budget. Those opposite are committed to cutting the defence budget by 41 billion dollars and cutting 3,700 jobs.
Order. Give a call to the honourable the Leader of the Nationals.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Infrastructure and Transport. Australia's top-selling car brand Toyota doesn't domestically sell a single vehicle that will meet the end point of the vehicle efficiency standards required to avoid the new family car tax. industry analysis shows the popular family SUV, the Toyota RAV4, will be taxed up to an extra $11,000 on every sale. Does the minister agree with the comments by the Minister for Climate Change and Energy that, and I quote, no particular model will go up?
The call to the minute. Order. Order. When the House comes to order, we'll hear from the Minister of Infrastructure, Transport, Regional Development and Local Government.
Well, here we go again. The political party of a $100 lamb roast. I had lamb on the weekend and I don't remember it being $100. It was very nice, thank you very much. The party of Whyalla will be wiped off the map. I haven't been there recently. I know the Prime Minister has. Millions of dollars of investment going into Whyalla. And, of course, the end of the weekend. Well, we saw it. Here we go again. You cannot believe a single thing these chicken littles of Australian politics say. Not a single thing. They know. The figure that they just quoted has been completely made up. Completely made up.
The leader of the Nationals.
On this side of the House, we want Australians to have greater choice in the new vehicles that they buy and to pay less of their hard-earned cash on fuel.
Order. The minister, the minister will pause. The member for Page, the leader of the Nationals, the member for Hume, screaming and yelling at someone while they're speaking is not only disrespectful, it's totally against the standing orders. Interjections are one thing, but yelling at someone while they're addressing the parliament is not on. And this minister particularly happens over and over again. Order. Order. So if you want to interject, interject. No more yelling. The minister has the call.
Well, as I said, in case you couldn't hear me, you cannot believe a single thing these chicken littles of Australian politics actually have to say. On this side of the House, we want Australians to have a greater choice of the new vehicles they buy and pay less of their hard-earned cash in fuel. We're consulting, of course, on a new vehicle efficiency standard that is right for Australia. But Australians have missed out on millions of dollars of fuel savings because of those opposite. Millions of dollars of fuel savings they could have been saving now because they lacked the courage to do anything about it. Now, the Leader of the Opposition and the Leader of the Nationals needs to explain why he thinks that Australia should not have access for cars that are cheaper to run. Why he thinks that Australians buying a new car should be paying more at the petrol bowser than those comparable in other countries. Explain why that. Explain why you think that is the case. And Australia has become, as we know, a dumping ground for less modern cars, and every day Australians are paying more at the petrol bowser because of it. We currently stand alone with Russia as one of the last advanced economies not to have a fuel efficiency standard. Now, the Leader of the National Party might want to align his policies with those of Russia, but I would rather line up with the 85% of countries in the global car market. His own colleagues, frankly, not only supported a standard when in government, they confirmed that it would not push up prices. And again, I quote, when fuel efficiency standards were introduced in the US, the most popular models before introduction stayed the most popular models after introduction, what we would call utes. There wasn't a material change in price, and we don't expect that there would be a material change in price here. There is not a single cost of living measure that those opposite don't want to vote against, including making sure Australians pay less at the petrol bowser.
Order. Hear from the member for Hawke.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Workplace Relations. How has the Albanese Labor government's workplace relations agenda contributed to strong wages growth after a decade of wages being kept deliberately low?
I give a call to the Minister for Employment, Workplace Relations and Minister for the Arts.
Thank you very much, Speaker. And I thank the member for Hawke, someone who came to this place campaigning to get wages moving, and is now part of a government that wants people to earn more and keep more of what they earn.
Order.
It was no accident that we had a decade of wage stagnation. There are decisions that governments take that determine whether or not wages move. If you don't advocate for a pay rise for low-paid workers in the annual wage review, if you don't advocate for a pay rise for aged care workers. If you see a broken bargaining system and you refuse to act to fix it, if new loopholes turn up and you don't act to close them, you end up with what they got, which is a decade of wage stagnation. The figures that were released last week show that wage growth now is running at roughly double what it averaged for nearly 10 years under the other side. And just as wages flatlining was no accident under them, wages now moving is no accident under this government. Because, and if you look at what drove, read the ABS section where it goes through what actually drove that 4.2% figure that came out last week. It was driven by the improvements. Two-thirds of the improvements of wage growth came from awards and enterprise agreements, the two measures that are directly affected by amendments to the Fair Work Act and by submissions taken by a government. The actions taken by this government to sunset zombie agreements, which were freezing wages and conditions, sometimes back to 2005 levels, has helped to get wages moving. Fixing the bargaining system has helped to get wages moving. Securing record pay rises for workers on the minimum wage and on awards, and delivering a 15% pay rise for aged care workers is all part of that 4.2% figure of getting wages moving again at roughly double what it was under those opposite. So what does that all mean for family budgets around the country? People are still, obviously, people are still doing it tough. Not nearly as tough as they'd be doing it if wages were still stagnant as they were under those opposite. Because an average full-time worker now, every week, earns $120 more than they did when we came to government. And under Labor's tax plan, they'll now get a tax cut of more than $2,100 a year. That's the alternative between having a government where people earn more and keep more of what they earn versus those opposite committed in when they're in government and now still committed in opposition to Australians working longer for less.
The call to the honourable member for Hume.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Assistant Treasurer. Labor's new family car and ute tax will impose penalties of $100 per ground kilometre. Does the minister agree with the comments of the Minister for Climate Change and Energy that, despite the imposition of his new family car and ute tax, the price of, and I quote, no particular model will go up?
Order. The Treasurer will cease interjecting or be warned. Once again, this is a very broad question, and it's asking for an opinion to say, does he agree with? So it's once again falling into that category of asking for an opinion. So we're going to allow it, just so that we're clear. Understanding Order 98, page 51, questioners must not ask ministers for an expression opinion. So we're going to allow the question. Yes, the Leader of the House.
And respect the questions being allowed. At any point this question time, is there going to be a question that goes to the Minister who has direct policy carriage?
Resume.
Like, we actually haven't had one.
Resume your seat. That is not a point of order. It may be a question, but it's not a point of order. Order. The Shadow Treasurer has asked his question. It's going to be allowed. The Assistant Treasurer is going to answer the question, but I suspect it will be. The member for Fairfax is warned. I'm just going to bring the House back to order. The Assistant Treasurer has the call.
Thanks, Speaker, and I thank the Shadow Treasurer for his question. And I note that it's 9 months since they've had an Assistant Treasurer shadow. 9 months.
Order.
And over that period,
order.
The Leader of the Opposition has formed the conclusion that there is nobody on his backbench who is good enough to do the job. Not one person who is good enough to do the job.
Order.
A conclusion that everyone on this side of the House concurs with, Deputy Speaker.
Order.
Now, over that 9 months, members of the Opposition have voted against cheaper medicines and made it quite clear to Australians that they want them to pay more for medicines when they go to the pharmacist.
The Assistant Treasurer will return to the question.
And indeed I will, Deputy Speaker, because the question the Shadow Treasurer asks me is a question about the cost of vehicles. And I'm pointing out to members of the House that quite clearly they want Australians to pay more for medicines. They want them to pay more for electricity. And now they're making it quite clear that they want them to pay more for petrol as well. Because the reason that Labor wants to introduce vehicle emission standards is because we believe that Australians deserve to drive vehicles which use less fuel. If you're using less fuel...
The Assistant Treasurer. Order. Order. Members on my right, the minister was answering a question about vehicles and fuel, which was your question. So you better be short and sharp with this response. On the leader, the member for Hume has the call.
The point of order is relevance. It was a very specific question. It was about Labor's part.
Well. Order. The member for Hume has asked his question. He's skating on thin ice with that point of order. The minister will be heard in silence.
Thanks, Speaker. And we're asked why it is that Labor wants to ensure that Australians can drive the most efficient vehicles, and the answer is quite simple. The reason that we want Australians to have access to the most efficient vehicles is we believe Australians should be paying less to fill up a tank of fuel. Less to fill up a tank of fuel as consumers in any other market around the world, because as the Minister for Infrastructure and Transport has pointed out to members in this house, Australia is one of the only countries in the world that has not yet introduced mandatory fuel standards, has not yet meant to do it. They didn't do it under the 9 years that this mob was in government, Deputy Speaker, and they are going to have access to cheaper fuels because we're going to have more efficient cars. And those opposite have made it clear time and time and time again that they want Australians to pay more for medicine, they want Australians to pay more for electricity, and now they're making it quite clear that they want Australians to pay more money when they fill up at the bowser.
Order. There is far too much noise. The member for O'Connor will leave the chamber under 94A. He's been constantly interjecting during question time. Order. He'll leave the chamber quickly. Order. The House comes to order. We'll hear from the member for Aston.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Treasurer. How is the Albanese Labor government working to get wages moving again and ensuring workers keep more of what they earn? And how does that compare with previous approaches?
Give a call to the Treasurer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and a big thank you to the member for Aston, who is helping to ensure that every taxpayer in her community and around Australia gets a tax cut, and 87% of the good people of Aston will get a bigger tax cut because of her efforts. Mr. Speaker, it's very clear in this question time what's going on. Only this side of the House cares about doing something about the cost of living pressures that people confront. And we know what those opposite are up to, Mr. Speaker. We know what they're up to. They think if they blow the dog whistle hard enough and if they cuddle up to the far right enough, that the good people of Dunkley won't recognise and won't realise that those opposite have said that they'll wind back our tax cuts, which is what the Deputy Leader has said.
Order.
And they might not care about the cost of living, Mr. Speaker, but we do. And we call on the opposition to stop stuffing around in the Senate and to pass the tax cuts that Australians need and deserve. Australians are under pressure, Mr. Speaker, and we'll get a sense of that in Wednesday's monthly inflation data. Those monthly numbers bounce around a bit, but the direction of travel is clear in the more reliable quarterly numbers. Inflation is moderating since its peaks in 2022, but Australians are still under pressure. And that's why wages growth is so important, and it's why the tax cuts are so important as well. Our economic plan is all about ensuring Australians earn more and keep more of what they earn. And what we saw in last week's data, as the minister said a moment ago, real wages growth is back as a feature of our economy and ahead of schedule, Mr. Speaker. And I say to those interjecting, real wages were falling 3.4% when we came to office, and now they're growing again. Average wage growth under this government is now around double what it was under those opposite. And that's because our policy is to grow wages and provide tax cuts for every taxpayer. Their policy was to suppress wages and to skew the tax cuts to the highest income earners, Mr. Speaker. New analysis shows average weekly ordinary full-time earnings have increased $119 a week since we came to office. That same worker will get a tax cut of $2,134. That means an extra $6,188 a year for the average full-time worker, Mr. Speaker. So it is now clearer than ever. As those opposite, they blow the dog whistle, they cuddle up to the far right, they have no plan for the cost of living. This side of the House, the Labor government, we are the party of higher wages and tax cuts for Middle Australia, because we believe people should earn more and keep more of what they earn. If those opposite had their way, inflation would be higher, wages would be lower, tax cuts would be smaller, and more people would be working longer for less.
We call to the honourable member for Goldstein.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. The Dunkley by-election is this weekend, and the late and great Peter Murphy wanted a full ban on gambling ads, saying, quote, "It needs to be done with no room for circumvention." Will the government honour her call?
Give the call to the Prime Minister.
I thank the member for Goldstein for her question, and indeed I join with her in honouring the late member for Dunkley. Peter Murphy is indeed sadly missed by not just people in the parliament across the spectrum, but certainly by people in her electorate. She had so much more to offer, and I say to Rod and to her family that I know that the passing of time has not dulled the grief that they are feeling. And I was there yesterday again, and people are really doing it tough to lose someone aged just 50. The member for Dunkley did make an outstanding contribution in her too short time in this parliament, and we recognise the work that she did leading the inquiry into online gambling harms, and we're indebted to her for her contribution on what is a critical issue. We have done substantial work already. We've launched BetStop, the National Self-Exclusion Register, through which over 18,000 Australians have self-excluded from online wagering and promotions, and I table the media release from the Minister for Communications. That has been achieved in just 6 months. We've mandated customer pre-verification for all new online wagering accounts to prevent children from gambling and strengthen protections for Australians. We've agreed with states and territories on new minimum classifications for video games with gambling-like content. We've implemented new evidence-based taglines to replace...
The Prime Minister was asked a question and is answering it regarding the reforms that are occurring. So he is being directly relevant. I know there is one specific part of the question the member has asked, but under the standing orders I've explained before, as long as the Prime Minister is being directly relevant, and he is to the core topic, I'll hear from the member for Goldstein.
Thank you, Speaker. On relevance, the question went to the future, not the past, and a ban on gambling ads.
The Prime Minister has the call.
I say with respect to the member, I'm talking about things that have been done right now, not the past, things that we are doing as a government to take action, consistent with what the member for Dunkley asked us to do. We have required online wagering companies to send their customers monthly activity statements outlining wins and losses. We've legislated a ban on use of credit cards for gambling last year, and this will come into effect mid this year and will make a real difference. In addition to that, the Minister for Communications and Minister for Social Services are working diligently through all 31 recommendations contained in the report chaired by the member for Dunkley. Government's undertaking relevant consultations, as you would expect us to do, with all stakeholders, including harm reduction advocates and industry. I myself have met with people like Tim Costello about these issues, and we're working them through to make sure that any action doesn't have unintended consequences, because that's what good governments do. The government has been working hard on a comprehensive approach to tackling gambling harm, because that's what we're committed to doing.
Order. The member for Boothby has the call.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the minister representing the Minister for Women. How will the Albanese Labor government's tax cuts support women to earn more and to keep more of what they earn?
Give a call to the minister representing the Minister for Women.
Thank you very much. And can I thank the member for Boothby for her question? Her long and distinguished career in the social services sector is really, and she means that she is an incredibly important asset to this place, particularly when it comes to vulnerable Australians, but also on issues around the cost of living. Now, Labor, of course, does want people to earn more and to keep more of what they earn. We know that those opposite want people to work longer for less. That's what those opposite want. Under Labor, wages growth means is double what it averaged under the Liberals and Nationals. And this wage growth means that women are earning more, and our tax reforms, of course, mean that they will get to keep more of what they earn. Yeah. And under Labor, the gender pay gap has dropped again to a record low, with the ABS reporting last week that the gender pay gap has dropped to 12%. This shows that Labor's deliberate efforts to support women's economic equality are working with very real and tangible benefits. That is because women's economic equality is a core priority for this government. These things do not happen by accident. It's because we've seen the work that we've done in industrial relations reform, the work that we've done in gender pay equity, the work that we've done in supporting aged care workers. All of that matters in making sure that we get that gender pay gap down. We know that tomorrow the Workplace Gender Equality Agency will be publishing employer-level gender pay gap reports, and this is the first for Australia, and it will give employees greater visibility of how their workforce is, workplaces are performing, and increase the transparency and focus on employers to accelerate change. This is on top of the reforms, as I said, that we've made in industrial relations to improve how it works for women, reforms that are making a difference to women's lives. Of course, our tax cuts will put more money back into the pockets of Australian women to provide cost of living relief. Our plan will see Australian women taxpayers on average receiving a tax cut of $1,649 from the 1st of July, and it will see a bigger tax cut for 90% of Australian women taxpayers, who will be receiving an additional tax cut of $707. That is 5.8 million Australian women across the country. We know that women work hard across our economy, and we want to ensure that they keep more of that hard-earned money to meet the daily challenges and cost of living pressures that they face. Under Labor's plan, childcare workers, disability carers, aged care workers are some of the most likely to benefit from these tax cuts, with 95% of those workers benefiting. These changes will ensure that those in middle Australia get to keep more of the money that they earn without adding to inflation. Labor will always work
Order.
Hard for
the
women,
minister's time
and soon the minister
concluded.
Will release the...
Give a call to the honourable member for Fairfax.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question goes to the Minister for Climate Change and Energy. Why, during Labor's cost of living crisis, is the government proposing a tax increase of $15,000 on the price of a new Toyota Hilux?
Order. Order. Members on my right will cease interjecting. The member for Lyons will cease interjecting. So will the member for Cooper. The Minister for Climate Change and Energy has the call.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and I deeply appreciate the question from the member for Fairfax. And I also think it should be noted I appreciate the bravery of the manager of opposition business for allowing that question, Mr. Speaker.
not every manager of opposition business, with everything he has on the record, would be strong enough to allow those questions to be asked. Now, the member asked me about price increases under a fuel efficiency standard or a new vehicle efficiency standard. Now, I would refer the honourable member to the impact statement, which the Minister for Transport and I released several weeks ago, which says and makes clear, evidence to date consistently finds no purchase price impact or negligible purchase price impact for consumers. And that's based on the experience right around the world, Mr Speaker. But to be fair, to the impact analysis, others have said it better. Others have said it better. Others have said it much more eloquently than I have, Mr Speaker. For example, when this has been tried in the past in Australia to implement this important reform, it was pointed out that when—and I'm quoting—when fuel efficiency standards were introduced in the US, the most popular models before introduction stayed the most popular models after introduction. There wasn't a material change in price, and we don't expect there would be a material change in price here. That was the member for Bradfield, Mr Speaker. The manager of opposition business is still in charge of the tactics, and he was a strong advocate. He put the case very strongly, very eloquently, Mr Speaker. There was an op-ed even in The Australian, Mr Speaker. Joint between the member for Bradfield and the then member for Keyong, the former future Prime Minister, Mr Speaker, who... And the headline, clean air and cars can be a much healthier mix. I table the op-ed, Mr Speaker, because the member for Bradfield, he was on a roll, Mr Speaker. He was on a roll in this op-ed. He said, fuel efficiency standards are about reducing fuel costs and carbon emissions at the same time. 80% of the global vehicle passenger fleet is subject to fuel efficiency standards, but Australia has none.
Member for Hume.
Australia has none, Mr Speaker.
Leader of the
and he's right. And this is not a radical policy, Mr Speaker. Order. These standards have been in place, and this is where prices have not gone up, as have been in place in the United States since 1975, almost as long as the member for Fairfax and I have both been alive. 1975, Japan 1985, China 2005, Order. South Korea 2006, the European Union 2009, Canada in 2011, vehicle emission standards were introduced, Mexico in 2013, India in 2014. Mr Speaker, those woke warriors, those well-known renewable energy inner-city dwellers, the government of Saudi Arabia introduced fuel efficiency standards in 2016 and New Zealand in 2023. It is well beyond time for Australia to catch up. It is well beyond time for Australia's consumers to have access to the same choices that 85% of motorists around the world get, but motorists in Australia and Russia do not.
Yeah. Give the call to the honourable member for Bennelong.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Aged Care and Sport. How is the Albanese Labor government helping our crucial aged care workers to earn more and keep more of what they earn?
Call to the Minister for Aged Care and Sport.
I thank the member for Bennelong for his question. Last week, he and I met with aged care workers in his electorate at Uniting Arunga in Ermington. And one of the many reasons that I am proud to be a member of this government is because we prioritise aged care workers and people like Joan, who the member for Bennelong and I met last week. Joan is a personal care worker who works and lives in the electorate of Bennelong. Joan told us that she started working in aged care more than 10 years ago with her friends Christy, Melinda and Judy. And when they began working in aged care last decade, Joan and her friends were receiving less than $20 per hour. Imagine that, being paid less than $20 per hour to do some of the most valuable and yet demanding work that we have in this country. But Joan stuck with it because she loves her job and because she loves the people that she looks after. And this year, for the first time, Joan was able to tell us that her pay now exceeds $30 an hour, for the very first time. And that is because the Albanese government made a commitment to back workers like Joan, like Christy, like Melinda and Judy in the Fair Work Commission to get a meaningful pay rise. And that is what we did. And that commitment has meant personal care workers like Joan are now taking home an additional $141 per week, or more than $7,300 every year. And on this side of the House, Mr Speaker, we recognise that there are tough economic realities at play at the moment. But, Mr Speaker, that is the difference between us and those opposite. We are determined to help. We are providing even more cost of living relief by making sure that people like Joan and her friends can earn more and keep more of what they earn. And from July 1, Labor's tax cuts will also deliver personal care workers in aged care an $1,166 tax cut, almost double what they were due to receive from the coalition. And this investment in aged care workers is paying dividends for the older Australians, the older people in their care. Under the Albanese government, there is now a registered nurse on site in aged care 98.7% of the time on average. That is 23.69 hours a day. Older people are receiving an additional 2.16 million minutes of care every single day. And there has been a reduction in the number of pressure injuries in aged care, the number of physical restraints used in aged care, and in significant unplanned weight loss in aged care. We are also seeing improvements in our star ratings data, with fewer 1- and 2-star rated facilities and more 4- and 5-star rated facilities. And today, Mr. Speaker, I met with the CEO of Dementia Australia, and she said that her members who live with dementia, who rely on the aged care system, who rely like personal care workers on the ground, they are seeing real differences on the ground now. And it's thanks to people like Joan.
Order. The Minister's time has concluded. Give a call to the Honourable Member for Wentworth.
My question is to the Minister for Education. Last May, the crossbench wrote to you with concerns about indexation of HECS and HELP loans, which are now over 7%. HECS indexation has risen faster than the average home loan and will cost the average 20 to 29-year-old more than $2,000 extra this year. Last year, we asked you to change the way the loans were indexed and to link them to a lower rate or to wage price index. And yesterday, the University's Accord recommended the same thing. When will the government change the way HECS and HELP loans are indexed and calculated and provide real financial support to young people who are going backwards?
The call to the Minister for Education.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and can I thank the member for Wentworth for her question? Without doubt, the best member for Wentworth this parliament has ever had. Well, even the Liberal Party agree. That's why they're trying to get you to join the Liberal Party. I take that as a compliment, though, because they realise that they can't beat you. My advice is don't do it. But better still, watch Nemesis and then you'd never do it.
Order.
Can I recognise, Mr. Speaker, your abiding interest in this topic, as well as all topics in education? Recognise also the work that you did before you came into parliament with the Australian Business and Community Network that has helped a lot of young people from my neck of the woods to get access to business communities and work experience in the time that they're at high school. I really mean that. That counts. It does make a difference in the things I was talking about in answer to the other question about helping to make sure that kids from the outer suburbs and poor backgrounds make that big step to university. I said earlier that Bob Hawke and Paul Keating had helped more young people to finish high school, and now we need more people to go to university. And I should have mentioned John Dawkins as well, because the fact is that HECS has blown the doors of universities open for more young Australians. Back then, in 1989, when I was finishing high school, only about 5% of the Australian workforce had a uni degree. Now it's more than 26%. And what this report says, and I'm going directly to it, I can promise you.
Order.
Give him a chance.
Just Minister will pause. The member for Wentworth on a point of order.
The point is on relevance. I appreciate the flattery, but I think it is time to get to the question of HELCS.
The minister was in mid-sentence saying he was getting to that point, so he is being directly relevant. I'm sure he was going to come back to the question, but order. He has the call.
You're a mind reader, Mr. Speaker. I was right on it. What the report says is that HECS is fundamentally sound, that it's served our country well, but that we can make it fairer and simpler. And it's got recommendations there for the government about changes to indexation as well as repayments. And my answer to your question is the answer I gave to the House only about an hour ago, which is that we're going through all of the 47 recommendations in the report and we'll announce the first stage of our response to the university's accord over the next few months.
The call to the member for Swan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Workplace Relations. What progress has the Albanese Labor government made towards closing the gender pay gap, and what reforms have contributed to this?
Give the call to the Minister for Employment, Workplace Relations and the Minister for the Arts.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker. And I really want to thank the member for Swan, someone who not only has been committed to acting on closing the gender pay gap since she got here, but right back to a time when the resources industry has always been so strong on it. The data last week, the gender pay gap is now the lowest it's ever been on record. The lowest it's ever been on record, down at 12%. It had averaged 15.4% under the previous government and now down to 12%. That's at the same time that a whole lot of women have been entering the workforce. More than 330,000 extra women are now in jobs since the election, but interestingly, 57% of those new jobs are full-time under this government. Now, it hasn't happened by accident or by coincidence. It's because of a deliberate design feature of this government wanting not only wages to get moving, but for that to happen in a way that the gender pay gap is closing. Some of the actions have been obviously targeted at pay and pay for women. Fixing the bargaining system to get wages moving, particularly in feminised industries, which is what we did with the Secure Jobs, Better Pay legislation. We also changed the law in that same bill to put gender equality at the heart of the Fair Work Commission's decision making. We backed and we funded the 15% pay rise for aged care workers. Overwhelmingly, a majority of workers in that industry are women. We also banned pay secrecy clauses, and many people here from all sorts of jobs know the exact connection between how pay secrecy has been used so that women in a workplace don't find out how much more their colleagues are earning than they have. That's now banned because of legislation put through by this government, I might add, opposed by those opposite. But there's also a second group of changes, not only the ones that were directly aimed at wages, but a set of changes that are directly aimed at improving participation. Expanding access to flexible work arrangements, making early childhood education, childcare, cheaper and more accessible for 96% of families, and delivering the biggest boost to paid parental leave since it was introduced. All of these measures mean that not only have we taken action to make sure that women are paid more, we've made it easier for women who want to return to the workforce and participate in the workforce to be able to do so. What that now means, the average woman working full-time in Australia now earns $135 a week more than when we came to office, and under the tax plan will get a tax cut of almost $2,000 a year. That's why we've managed to get the gender pay gap to the lowest level it's ever been recorded. But as far as this government's concerned, that job is not yet done. There's more to go to make sure we can eliminate that gender pay gap.
Yeah. Give a call to the Honourable Member for Menzies.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Climate Change and Energy. I refer to Labor's new family car and ute tax. Last year.
Order. Members on my right, there is far too much noise. If members on my right continue to interject, they will leave the chamber. I don't know how many times I have to tell everyone. Questions are going to be heard in silence, and then ministers will be given the same courtesy. So, out of respect for the member for Menzies, he'll begin his question again.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Climate Change and Energy. I refer to Labor's new family car and ute tax. Last year.
Order. Just the member will resume his seat. On the point of order, the Leader of the House.
Yeah, Mr. Speaker, question time. Ministers can be asked about issues within their responsibility. They can't be asked about something fictitious. He's referring to a policy that does not exist.
Order. Members on my right. The member for McNamara is warned. I can't make any member phrase a question as I see fit. It is up to that individual. Obviously, the minister can respond accordingly. We've had this issue before over the last couple of weeks. I just ask for everyone to temper their language. And for the third time, we're going to ask the member for Menzies to get to his question and be heard in silence.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Climate Change and Energy, and I refer to Labor's new family car and ute tax. Last year, in my home state of Victoria, 78% of sales were either SUVs or light commercial vehicles and utes. The top-selling cars were the Ford Ranger, Toyota Hilux and Isuzu D-Max. Industry analysis shows that they would attract penalties of $17,000, $14,000 and $13,000 respectively by 2029. Why does this Labor government want to punish Australians for their choices?
Order. Give a call to the Minister for Climate Change and Energy.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker. Again, I very much appreciate the question. In fact, I appreciate being asked it more than the member appreciate being asked to ask it, Mr. Speaker, because he's been put in a rather tricky situation. Because, Mr. Speaker, what we're about is giving Australians more choice of more fuel-efficient vehicles. And in fact, for electorates that are in outer urban areas or regional areas, Mr. Speaker, they save more in fuel costs by having more efficient cars because they drive more. They drive more. Mr. Speaker,
Members on my left,
that is the fact, but others have said it more eloquently than I have, Mr. Speaker. The member for Bradfield, writing in The Australian, wrote, and I quote,
order.
Given the long distances travelled in regional Australia,
order.
The savings could be even greater for people
business.
Living outside the main cities, Mr. Speaker. When he's good, he's good, isn't he, Mr. Speaker? When he's good, the member for Bradfield. Now, again, I have to confess, Mr. Speaker, I quoted the member for Bradfield earlier and I left a sentence out, which I shouldn't have done. I talked about how in the United States, the member for Bradfield was arguing, demand for cars was the same before fuel efficiency standards as what are after, but he actually went into more detail than that. He said, and I'll give the full quote, so when fuel efficiency standards were introduced in the US, the most popular models before introduction stayed the most popular models after introduction. This is what I left out last time. Essentially, what Americans call pickup trucks and what we would call utes, Mr. Speaker, like the Chevy Silverado, there wasn't a material change in price, and we don't expect there would be a material change in price here, Mr. Speaker. So we've got an opposition that is so negative that they oppose our policies. Fair enough, we're used to that. But they oppose their own policies as well, Mr. Speaker. Now, I suspect, Mr. Speaker, the opposition could do with looking at how some groups have responded to this policy, groups that actually represent the interests of motorists, Mr. Speaker.
Order.
Like Australia's oldest motoring group, the NRMA. The NRMA who said,
order.
Who said the NRMA welcomes the release of the Australian government's announcement and we are pleased that a responsible and achievable option over time is being presented to the Australian people. So the chief executive of the NRMA, which has been standing up for motorists since 1920, which is about 104 more years than they have, Mr. Speaker, because they actually don't stand up for Australian motorists, or Choice, who stand up for Australian consumers across the board.
The Leader of the Nationals.
They said the absence of standards in Australia has made Australia an unattractive market for more efficient vehicle manufacturers. Choice stands up for consumers. The NRMA stands up for consumers and motorists. This side of the House stands up for consumers and motorists. That side of the House
order.
Just stands for scare campaigns which won't survive contact with reality.
The call order. We'll give the call to the honourable member for Corangamite.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Health. How is the Albanese Labor government working to ensure Australians have access to the health services they need? And why is it important to strengthen Medicare after a decade of cuts and neglect?
The call to the Minister for Health and Aged Care.
Thank you, Speaker. I thank the member for Corangamite for that question. She is such a huge advocate for Australian workers earning more and keeping more of what they earn. She also knows that the wage figures that were released last week showed that workers in healthcare and social assistance saw their wages rise last year by 5.5%. And from July 1st, Labor will deliver every single healthcare worker in the country a tax cut to help with the cost of living, like the hundreds and hundreds of Australians working hard right now at the Frankston Hospital
order.
In southeast Melbourne. A second-year registered
order.
Nurse, Mr. Speaker, at that hospital will get a tax cut of $1,550, double what they would have received under the Morrison government plan. A hospital orderly at the Frankston Hospital, Mr. Speaker, will get a tax cut of $862, compared to just $58 under those opposite, or $1 a week, a miserly $1 a week, Mr Speaker. And there will be more orderlies and more nurses working at the Frankston Hospital after the redevelopment of that hospital is completed next year, the largest ever health project in south-east Melbourne delivered by the Victorian Labor government. And that new, bigger, more modern hospital will be working with more funds from the Commonwealth after the Prime Minister agreed with National Cabinet a new hospital funding formula that will deliver at least $13 billion in additional funding to Australia's hospitals like the one at Frankston. But, Mr Speaker, I'm not the only one out there right now talking about hospital funding.
Order.
There's an ad, another ad, doing the rounds down in Dunkley right now, trumpeting the former government's allegedly terrific performance on funding hospitals, and it's labelled fact, Mr Speaker. So, of course, it must be right. But, Mr Speaker, there are a few salient facts not included in the ad, like the fact that the Leader of the Opposition, in his first budget as Health Minister, cut $700 million from Victorian hospitals. $700 million. Just a small down payment for the $50 billion that he planned to cut from hospitals over a decade, set out in this glossy budget document from 2014, Mr Speaker. I regret to say, Mr Speaker, this Leader of the Opposition is becoming a serial offender when it comes to spurious claims about his record as Health Minister, like talking a big game on bulk billing without telling anyone that he planned to abolish the thing altogether, or taking credit for headspace services that had been funded years earlier by the Gillard government in the 2011 budget, Mr Speaker. Mr Speaker, the truth is that this Leader of the Opposition, when he was Health Minister, delivered only one thing, and that was cuts to the health system, and the Australian people will never forget it. Yeah.
Call to the Prime Minister.
I ask that further questions be posted in the notice paper.